Can a middle-class Lutheran church work with the poor? The second part, why a preferential option for the poor, has been one of the basis of liberation theology. And as I talked with Julia over that theme, I wondered if that, you know, would be attractive for everybody, be confusing, how much time would we have? We would start maybe different areas of interest as well as background in that, but I think we can get to it with the other question, because that's where we start as a Lutheran church. My experience is we are a middle-class church. And then when we get excited about things like liberation theology, work with the poor, and to me, what is the challenges before us now, particularly in Latin America, we offer what we offer, which is much more a church that's used to working with the middle class, and that brings some values with it, some personal experiences for each of us as North Americans to enter into areas that living conditions are much different than we're used to. Schooling for children, if you have children, how we identify with the poor, because certainly they have their experience of life that they bring to the challenges of life, the reality, their perspective. And some of these are very difficult for North American people. So out of that has grown lots of controversy about liberation theology. And I brought along some books, I'll just show them later, just not knowing who might be more interested in reading, and these are ones I felt good about. But some of these liberation theologians have been really challenged by the Catholic Church, since that's really what we're talking about, is the Roman Catholic Church. The Protestant Church in Latin America still works with the middle class. That's characteristically true. I talked with a variety of missionaries trying to learn about, well, what about the Assemblies of God or the Pentecostals? Don't they kind of work more with the marginalized, the down and out, since that had been some of my experience in the United States? And I was getting mixed answers, so I don't have a clear response to that one. But I did find some who were very quick to say, no, Lutherans can't work with the poor. They don't know how. But a Pentecostal can, because their theology is here, we'll just say it, put it that way, but the experience is here, and so they can enter with their experiential understanding of God and worship of God, and whatever theology is, I think they have some good theology, because as I looked at the what we would call evangelicals of the Pentecostal nature, they're the quickest to have lay leadership in the churches. And in our own particular experience with Lutherans, we found that the tradition of 20-some years of our mission, still there were no Peruvians doing the sacraments, because, you know, that's sort of set apart for the ordained people. And that would be probably, I think you might agree to, the characteristic of our tradition. In contrast, then, to a Pentecostal experience, which is much quicker, so that we would say you can be a plumber tomorrow or yesterday and a pastor today, and probably for Lutherans that would be some problem for us, and for some good reason. Okay, that's just a little background where I tried to ask questions about what does it mean to be Lutheran. These particular slides I don't have to show, I'm still sort of talking to myself about them. I was going to show some very quickly. Just poverty situations. Now, we have poverty in our own country, and if we take the poverty of our own experience here in the United States, then these maybe aren't even helpful, if you see what I'm saying. But they are helpful in one regard, for those who are interested in what's called a preferential option to the poor. If you are interested in that, And because that is growing out of third world experiences, especially I think Latin America, but I believe there are other places in the world, particularly south of the equator, then we understand the theology that is being written and translated into English, and we have something to dialogue with that we can take and see how does that fit. It still leaves us at the end saying, can we as a Lutheran church, I wouldn't even say can we, well, can we is okay, can we do it, but also, do we want to? How committed are we? I've discovered by coming back to the United States, several bishops have been glad to talk with me because, you know, this inclusiveness now in the Lutheran church, they want that. But I've gotten real mixed messages about how committed they are to that. And I have discovered in a Christian Century article in January that said most seminary graduates want to go to the suburbs. And so I believe somebody was here the other day, did something on inner city. Was that you folks maybe, or no? I didn't
City get Lutherans in Action. City Lutheran people working in the cities.
Okay, City Lutherans in Action. Which I saw as a way to say, in a sense, marginalize, since if Lutherans in our traditional economic level are moving away from the cities, moving away from churches in the cities, so that some of the churches I've known in Los Angeles, they used to sit 900, you know, you have 30 in there now, and they're saying, well, now we really should start relating to the neighborhood. Seems a little late. I was real disappointed by a couple of things that were presented to me because I just said, well, boy, we're setting ourselves for failure before we start. What's our commitment to doing that? Okay, I think I will do this, and it might, because I don't really want to talk today. I don't mind coordinating some things, but as I've worked on this and kind of sifted through it, there's some things I'd like to say, but at the same time, I need a little feedback because as coming back into the country, I feel at times that I'm not quite connected yet with what's going on, and I would like to hear what people have, how they have approached some of this, maybe in their own reading. What I'm going to do that might help us. So I'm going to read a couple sections of the scripture, then I'm going to show you some of the poverty that is part of Latin America, and then we're going to respond, taking that scripture, taking those images, if you will, and approach from your creativity how you might see as a good way to go about doing ministry. Okay, just sort of jump at it that particular way. Let me see here. This is from Luke 4. All of them are very familiar passages. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And John 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. The true light that enlightens every man was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world knew him not. He came to his own home, and his own people received him not. But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. full of grace and truth, and we have beheld his glory. Let's do this with a minimal talking and just let you fill in some of the blanks. Occasionally I'll make a comment if it seems confusing. This is part of getting our own focus on what's happening. People were in the mountains, and these past 20 to 40 years, the great movement to the cities, leaving this particular life and this poverty, and then bringing that to the cities. Oh, they're choosing for reasons of terrorism and reasons of desire for education for their children. Here we are in the city. And for some economic situations too. And also health. Shining Path. All children wear uniforms in Peru to school, except the American school. And they're standing here in line for kerosene because most people cook with that. That's their version of pumpkin. That's for the people who like pork. These are the street merchants. 65%, I think, of the population sells in this manner outside the economy. Okay, as they enter then into the city and they go home, this is home for a majority in Lima.
Is this the kind of community you work in?
I worked in a community like this. This is, I'll show you. They begin in this manner with first just like a tent, you might say. Then they work up to putting up four walls. They grab some electricity from somewhere and they just run it, sometimes over the Pan American Highway. And most of the land is like that. There are a few places that aren't as sandy, of course. No trees. They are, in some areas, are able to grow trees, but they really, it doesn't receive rain in Lima. Some people, of course, live on garbage dumps, and so there was that representation of what that's like. These are called callejones, which is like little streets, and each of these sections becomes a family home. This is inner city. This isn't... Shantytown has almost more space around it, so I prefer them to these because the population density is so... Two, I was inner city with callejones, and then in a community like this, although we didn't receive our water that, or they didn't receive their water that way. This is the boys who shine their shoes in the city having a meeting, discussing the wages, I imagine. This is a word for bureaucracy. For as part of doing anything, you have to come to grips with bureaucracy. That's the prettier downtown area of Lima and the suburbs called San Isidro and Miraflores. This is a representation of how I think both the rich view the poor and the poor see the rich in a sense of power and domination. In 1988, there were more strikes in Peru than had ever been in their history. Oh, excuse me. Let's see if this backs up. No. Guess what? It doesn't back up. Well, we'll give it a shot. You want to just back it up?
There's a button here.
The lower one, yeah. That's right, yeah. Oh. It's just sort of fussing around still. Okay. One step backward, two steps forward.
Sorry, I asked.
Yes, that's in the right direction. One more. Okay. This has to do with... this word's for water, this is for transportation, and this is for health. Those are real important things, and so they're marching for a solution to those kind of things to get the people in power to pay attention to them, because on the outside, they begin kind of always on the edge of a city, available land for invasion, and then they have to seek a way to get people's attention that their needs are great. So they're saying, give us bus transportation in this area, or that's the usual thing. There are some little Volkswagen-type buses that'll go out. And then water means that they're probably having water trucks come out, and they're saying, hook us up to the city water. And then, of course, the health, there are some health facilities, but most of our time in Peru, I think the doctors were on strike. You would go to a private place to get help. This has to do with mining. Mining's a real central part of Peru, and there were lots of miner strikes while we were there, and then one of our friends was really good friends with one of the leaders of the mines, and he was shot this last year because they had been on strike for like 90 days or so. And there is a right-wing military group in Peru, and I think they took credit for shooting him, which takes care of a little of the opposition, I guess. But those people lived in Lima, and then like ladies where I worked said, well, let's bring them food, and you know, they want to help out because they believe in what they call shoulder-to-shoulder, working with each other. This says we have hunger, we want peace. This is just put in there because the bank is on strike. I mean, everybody is on strike. Yeah, right. This is the bank of the nation. Well, everybody strikes for more pay. When you have 2,000% inflation, you can't keep up with your paycheck. So this is the one that says peace and human rights is the work for all Peruvians. I'm not sure what that meant. I think it was a way of appeasing people that the government was doing something. There were more disappeared people in Peru than any country in the world last year. And I think they documented it at 156 or something, the World Watch or America Watch, but others had the total much higher. And in 86, right, there had been a prison massacre, and then the commission finally took a year to get their report back, and there wasn't anything to report. Nobody was guilty, even though most of the prisoners had been shot in the back of the head. The march of women from the Comas area, who are mothers, and they're saying don't, for the forgotten mothers. Okay, this is transportation when there's the strikes. People get where they can. Okay, in a Pueblo Joven. This is the last Inca who fought against the Spaniards. And so one of the revolutionary groups is named Tupac Amaru. And it's a reminder of the campesinos, the farmers, their need for their needs. This is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's something that some of the Catholic groups especially do to try to teach people they have rights and the Peruvians have a good constitution. So this was a little drawing someone had done. The poor Christ. They identify with a suffering Christ. And if the big word is peace, then you can put together that one. But people organize and they meet, they have a level of democracy, of involvement, which can sometimes bring them to action. Okay, I think that's as far as we're going. There are some who do. It's interesting, some of the major families, some of the Spanish families basically have been there, you know, for 450 or so years. And so you'll have famous names, and those names will be on the right-wing political parties and on the left-wing political parties, and be uncles or cousins or whatever. And I don't know if they have Christmas parties, but I always wondered what it would be like. Well, they had a movement for many years with what's called the opera government. A man's name was Aya de la Torre, and he was exiled and he was imprisoned. And finally, his party got into government in 1985, which is now in government, and never been in power before. They've been studying PRI in Mexico, which is the Mexican government, which has been in power for so long. And so there's a big fear that they'll never get out of government. And they are known for their corruption, which has helped bring the country to an economic situation that's quite bad, as well as to a situation of lack of confidence in the government. Well, what I'd like to do, and well, maybe you have some questions, but kind of maybe work those in. What I was hoping to do is, you've connected for a moment with this kind of poverty. You've maybe brought some other questions with you. We have the scripture mandates to talk about preaching the good news of the poor. How do you think you do it? When you have these kinds of odds, I tried to give you a little spectrum of the economic, the political, the human rights, how people organize to work together to better their situation, and where you might see the role of the church in that. Well, I was looking at 5 minutes. The LCA, Lutheran Church of America, was their invitation of Peruvians, they said. What had happened was, some 25 years ago, the Germans, who were there around 1900 and had a big church, some of their kids were starting to intermarry with Peruvian people. Almost all the Germans I met were born in Peru, but were still German, and were part of the Lutheran Church, held their services in German, and their cultural event in German, so they became what's called a foreign community. And they asked a North American missioner to do work with their youth. This particular missioner, I don't know his name, soon realized that because of the needs of Peru, it wasn't fair to sort of try to work with the German youth and try to keep them from marrying the Peruvians. At least it's been simplified that way to me. There maybe were some other factors involved. So he was part of reaching out to the needs, how he understood the church could respond to some needs. And with the Germans, too, because they end up being the property owners of two locations that became churches, both of them about 25 years ago. One is in the inner city, not far from downtown. It's called Breña, which I looked up in a dictionary, meant bramble. And that's where we would see callejones, this density of population. It's, I didn't enjoy going there at night because it's an area of a lot of people in the streets, the biggest potholes in the world, high drug use, lots of robberies, that kind of stuff. Really not a whole lot different than a lot of urban cities that you might find in the States, too. Then the other group was to the south, like 25 miles out of town. And they ended up calling a pastor so that they had a North American as their pastor, and the inner city one had a North American as their pastor. And then from that group in the inner city, a lady went and invaded some land, who was a widow lady with some couple of children, and that pastor went out with her, and they invaded. And he actually, I think, some of his own resources, as I was told, helped her put up a little building out of adobe. You have to understand, invasion means they invaded, they were there 8 months, the government said you can't be here, and so the government replaced or moved them to a different location where they're much farther away from transportation, and from which also means the amount of time you have to travel to go to a place of employment and back, but they had a piece of land. And there's a lot of belief among the people that a human right is employment and some good housing, or at least some place to call home. And we see them a little more as privileges in our society. They understand it as a right. So he, because he helped her, she said she'd like to make the living room of her home a church. So when I came, which would be 20 years later, they were saying, could you do it all differently because it's not working? We don't want anybody to be pastor of a church anymore who's a foreigner. Would you accompany the Peruvians, be there, be of assistance, help train them so that they can get some accreditation, maybe even recognition from like the World Lutheran World Federation to be called a church? There's only one legal church in Peru of the Lutherans, and that is the Germans. So when Lutheran World Federation invites somebody like this next year to Brazil to the assembly, they would be inviting the German church. They wouldn't, which would be upper class people, they wouldn't be inviting these poor Lutherans, nor I believe would they be inviting the, there's two other major sets of Lutherans in Peru. One would be the Norwegians, out of their mission society, and they are in different cities than Lima. And then the other one is the World Mission Prayer League. Has their office in Minneapolis and also an office in Canada. And so we kind of related occasionally to these people. Anyway, so my goal was to go and accompany people and their invitation. And what I began to realize in doing that, of course, is as your situation's getting worse and worse politically, economically, and I'm to connect them with their local resources are just drying up. And the couple I was working with, which I was real fortunate to have a Peruvian couple to work with, and I like both of them, so that we could spend some social time together as well. They did not live in the Pueblo Joven, and one of the goals was to have leaders of that local group coming from the Pueblo Joven themselves. And what should I add to that? We're not talking about a Lutheran church where you have a paid clergy. We're talking about a church of the poor. Much of the model is based on Roman Catholic models. But what do Catholics do? They pay, or they offer clergy or religious people. And I began to realize parts of the model were taken were good, and parts just didn't fit when you had a family. And the Catholics that we were aware of with Marinol, there were some real concerns that the Marinol family, the lay family, had come, one of their first ones, and they refused to live in the Pueblo Joven they were being told to live in. There were other North Americans also saying, well, who had married Peruvians, and some of them had even lived in Pueblo Jovens, and were saying it's not a good time to live in a Pueblo Joven now, because the economy and with the growing terrorism were so obvious, we stand out, that you'll never be accepted. Just accept the fact, as a foreigner, you can never be accepted. You can work and love these people and accept it in a manner of a relationship, but don't get the idea they're going to think of you like one of their own. This turned out to be interesting dialogues with other missioners who had been there for a number of years as well, and discovered they might speak the language just beautifully. They might even live in a Pueblo Joven, but everybody knew if things got bad, they could go back to the States. They had access to funds. So that we could never quite totally identify. The project I like, I still do, because I think it is a challenge. Can we identify with the poor? Can we trust the poor to be our teachers? I found that sounds good and everybody agree with that, but you get in situations And when things are bad, I would hear like one of my predecessors, he trusted the Peruvians. His best friend was this Peruvian. And then later he found out this Peruvian was writing checks, signing the missioner's name. And so there comes this thing, oh my goodness, one of my best friends is corrupt too. I don't think that is to say that Peruvians are corrupt. I think it's a way of saying, do we not trust them? And then there's never a national church, which was my personal goal, there would be a national church. I think Peru is the only area where there is of the missionary parts of the world for the ELCA that there is not a national church. You know what that means? That means that when the money comes, it comes to us as missionaries. And in our society or group of missionaries, we received the money, we had our budgets, and we decided how to use it. We had three congregations we worked with, but until we left, they had not agreed, we had not together agreed, that the Peruvians should be in on receiving the money. And so that's still an issue in the mission. Because as long as we receive the money and we can give it out to, say, let's rent a bus, we're going to take the kids somewhere, there's always a kind of sense of, well, what are they doing? What do these northerners have in mind for us? How are they going to manipulate us? That was one of my concerns and ways I tried to evaluate myself. How do I motivate without manipulating? Because there's places I would like to see the people I was working with kind of reach an awareness, usually in areas in which they would take responsibility for something, because previously the missionaries had done those things. And I don't know if I'm answering Jerry's question, because one of the fascinating parts of getting into an area like this is to realize that we're not really prepared for it. We can agree with philosophies, but when you actually get in an area, you first have to learn all the history that came before, because all those Peruvian people in this case will know that history. And then if we're working in development, I found my best resources were Lutheran World Relief people, because they had really been trained in development concepts. How do you not just hold the money out, but work with people to have them organize, write letters, whatever it takes to go get the money for themselves. Much of the model, as I said, is based on some Roman Catholic studies let me pause for a minute. With liberation theology, the commitment to the poor, although Gustavo says he first referred to it, this is the writer of this book, who became known as the father of liberation theology. He says he first referred to liberation theology in 1968. And then when the Catholics had a meeting in Colombia in a place called Medellin, he was one of the theological formers of that time. And so the Catholic Church began to say, we have been connected with power structures through history, particularly in Latin America. When you have the president's house, mansion, in the downtown square of the capital city, then next to that will be the archbishop's residence. And that's been their history. And that's why it's so important to the Catholic Church, Latin America and Central America and South America, because the majority are Catholic people. In fact, the major majority of the continent. So they began to almost say, we confess our sins that we have identified with the rich and the powerful at the expense of the poor, and we will change that now. Then they had a meeting in a place called Puebla, Mexico, and they did the same thing. And I probably could read a comment out of that, because the things they said are things that we value. And because Lutherans, although there are many Lutherans in Brazil, and there's lots of this concern in Brazil, I didn't hear it from the Brazilian Lutherans. Again, a middle class, upper class church. Large, 1 million people. But it was out of the Catholic Church that some of these concerns were voiced. Let's see if I can talk and see if I have a quote, because I don't think I can do that. That's like chewing gum and walking for me. Okay. With a concern for the poor, here we are, good. This comes out of the Mexico statement. Again, this is for Catholics. It says, the poor merit preferential attention, whatever may be the moral or spiritual situation in which they find themselves. Made in the image and likeness of God to be his children, his image is dimmed and even defiled. That is why God takes on their defense and loves them. Now, I can get into that a little bit later, trying to click back in what Jerry's question was. To take a project and to gear it towards the poor, we Lutherans first had to say, we're used to paying our pastors. So that had been our tradition in Lima as well. If you would act as pastor, you could get a stipend. If you would study even with a North American pastor, you could get a stipend. We learned that several of the people studying were supporting their whole families with the stipend. And so, well, yeah, it was wonderful. Some of them weren't studying real hard, unfortunately. But I got to know a variety of those people, and I really realized there were some differences between North Americans and the Peruvians at that point. I got to a point myself, I didn't mind being took to a degree. I felt like if I didn't risk being taken, then I was always going to be the great white father judging everything, and you had to have a little give and take. When we arrived in Peru, we were told there'd be 9 students we could work with to train to be pastors. Well, first we discovered that this was 9 students that a former missionary had identified could be trained. The congregations had never done that. And that's a North American model. Go off to seminary, get trained, you go out and somehow you find your calling. And I never thought much about it until I realized, working with some other people, they would say, oh my goodness, you North Americans are so peculiar. The way we do it is we would say, we want this person who is acting as our pastor to receive more training to be our pastor, to be better at counseling and stewardship and evangelism. And so they would say that. And that to them seemed normal. That was a real learner for me, because I was realizing that you just wouldn't to these poor groups say, okay, this one's trained, it's going to be your pastor. Well, not if you're trying to accompany people and work through a whole process with them. You wouldn't turn around and say, we Northerners, we feel this one is smart enough, studied enough, you got him. Well, I mean, these are all the kind of things you keep learning, and I feel for the mission still, because so many things, you know, you've done, you've screwed up, and you've got to have some time to let those settle again and go back at it. One of the other ones in this case was, of those 9 students, they all came to a meeting. They were a little bit skeptical, and with the issue of ordination was raised. What's ordination? Well, ordination became kind of internationally accredited, that you are a real Lutheran pastor, that you're not just sort of locally trained by some guys from the States, but it gets accepted in Brazil and all over. I don't know what you think about that. That was an interesting one for me, because the international acceptance is important. And Peruvians wanted that. They didn't, if they're going to work, they wanted to be respected and not feel they got some cheap diploma, see. So finally, when the classes were offered, started with five, and pretty soon we worked down to two. And then the two finally said to the teacher they had, "I think we'd just be happy having a Bible study." Because of many of the things you've already heard, they realized they hadn't really been asked by their congregations to be pastors. They weren't receiving a stipend or anything that would say, as some Methodists or other groups will say, "We'll give you a stipend, you study, or we'll send you to Chile, the seminary there, or to Argentina, where there's a Lutheran seminary, or to Brazil, where a couple of them wanted to go. But you study, and you can be the pastor of a Lutheran church and a Pueblo joven, dealing with all the stuff you saw, all the challenges of life that are just immense and difficult, because you have to realize you're doing funerals because of the children who are, particularly it's children, but also like the one congregation lost the 19-year-old who was their musician, their guitar player, who got TB. And it's a terrible disease. You just sort of die off. You find as a missionary, you get your car and you're running in hospital and you're trying to get medicine. And so anyways, they're saying that's what they're committed to. And they are. They're marvelous people. They're still committed. But the ones I talked with said, if I'm going to study, I would love to go out and just get it over with, get my studies over with, and come back and be a pastor. I heard that one a couple times. I mentioned the Methodists because the Methodists reopened their seminary in Lima, and were offering. Methodists have been there for over 100 years in Peru, so they had people coming from all over to Peru, and they're having them in dormitories downtown, and which is where their seminary was. And then they're offering field experience in areas like this, because the man who's head of it really believes that he's not just trying to fill pulpits in some churches, but he wants to work with people who are committed to their country and to the poor. This one, I think so. What happened, the reason I said out too, is he has several then he hopes can get scholarships to the United States. This would be of the Methodists. What's the advantage of that? I think he's hoping to give them some training so they can come back and also be teachers in that same seminary, because this in the past Lutherans have also taught in that. We have one of the Lutherans was teaching in that seminary, and the rest of us were all asked to teach. And which was finally, you know, approved. We could have all taught there. But the reason that didn't work for the Lutherans, which is another side to having to struggle with this, by offering stipends, what you do to people is you take them away from whatever job they had. And the commitment that this time was the LCA had was we were not going to remove people from their employment and then just get them by with stipends and then finally say, now you're finished, go get a job and go be a pastor for whatever you can do. They felt it would be better if we did one-on-one working with the people. They would keep their lives, their employment, and everything, and then return to, when they finished their studies, they already had their jobs, their livelihood, and they had everything that way. I don't know if I want to say that like the Mormons, but I think the Mormons have a concept of you have your job. In Peru, it's a little different. I mean, the Mormons probably offer the Peruvians is the big carrot, is to go to the States and study and get your degree and then go back and do it that way. But anyways, the idea of working. Methodists, it's been a concern for Methodists, certainly, and they're only in the second year of this. Okay, let me see if I can respond to that. These are people. Even in the inner city, they had two people there who at first wanted to be ordained, actually three. The two men kind of dropped off. the woman really has stayed with it, and she is employed. They come with that kind of motivation to do it, but they also have to deal with the reality is, if they could go to, by the way, let me say that they can't go to the Methodist seminary if they're employed, because the Methodist classes are in the daytime. They can't go to a Catholic seminary because they're not permitted to, particularly for a woman. So it has to be us offering one-to-one instruction for these people. And what was happening, some say it's economic pressure. I don't think that was it myself, because I really found them committed. I think there must have been something else. But they, I think some of them wanted to go to Costa Rica, for example, has a seminary, and just do that and come back. I think their congregation, we could work out the call thing in the time too, because I believe their congregations already were receiving the leadership of all the people we're referring to. It just wasn't clear. Were they connected to the missionaries as sort of our underlings, or were they connected to the congregation? Okay. These people have so much time in their lives. And the fellow I worked with, Ugo, he really wanted to talk theology and read some things with me, and we talk about it. But he said, you know, I can't take those classes, even if they're one-to-one, because I realize I need to support my family. And I realize this church will always be a part of my life, but it'll never be an income part of my life, which you realize gets to be a luxury for me as a missionary, receiving a salary, working with these people, and here they're not receiving any pay for doing a majority of the work. And so Ugo was studying to become what he wanted to be was an urban geographer. And finally he got teaching two classes at the Catholic University in the lower geography, the introductory geography classes. His wife was also doing some things. She also was one of the people who started the classes. And with two children, they didn't have enough left over. I mean, you can imagine doing all that. And so one of the young women said to me, she says, I love to study this. But she said, I realize I need to get a teaching degree if I'm really going to be effective as a pastora, which is a nice part about Spanish. You don't have to get confused. It's pastor would be a male, and pastora is a female, and it's all nice and put together, and it feels real natural in terms of the male-female linguistics. And she was right. She would have to be employed, and so she said, I want to be a teacher. I want to work with children. In the process of studying for that, I'll get skills I can use and work in and use in the church. So she quit the program so that she could, she's poor and tuition went up, so that was a whole nother problem. So we had at that point agreed we could give some scholarship help to people. I mean, you got to be flexible constantly. We said, we've got to offer some scholarship help, and if she's a good leader, good lady, we'll help her go to school to be a teacher. And that's not studying to be a pastor, but on the other hand, we felt it met our kind of changing, what would you say, kind of in the birth process of what we'd like to see as a national church under the Peruvians. Well, that's a long way around, but did that cover some things? Or you got some new questions? Other churches? No, it'd be a National Lutheran Church. Yeah. In Peru, you have Anglicans because the British controlled Peru for a while, and you do have a white British pastor as their bishop, but you do have Peruvian pastors. In the Methodists, on the other hand, they use the bishop form as well, and he is a Peruvian, and so they have Peruvian leadership, and what they do is they receive missionaries, and then they take those missionaries and say, here's where we'd like you to be. So the relationship is with the National Church of Peru and with the National Methodist Church here through their mission sending group, so that the direction is set by them. Our goal with the mission there is to take the is to make the direction not ours, but the Peruvians. And this last year, we in talking with some of the leaders, because we're trying to form what would be a mutual ministry committee, and said, in terms of some new possibilities for ministry, they said, why don't you do it? And we had kind of written up our own goals, which said, we will do new projects if accompanied by a Peruvian. And then turned around, the Peruvian said, hey, we're just barely keeping up with what we got. And things are not stable, even in the church. The church life is affected by the chaos, really, of that kind of political, economic situation. Why don't you do it? And that was kind of throwing it back to us. So we were always kind of relooking at our own identity. And the Peruvian groups, we began to try to help them relate to each other. And by the time we left, there's three Lutheran congregations. And actually, I've worked with all three. They were still friendly with each other, but hadn't figured out how they were going to work with each other. Does that make sense? It's, if you form a new association, how do you work with each other? And one of the groups was going to do what would be called incorporation for their land. So another one thought, well, we'll incorporate as well. And then the third group that I worked with said, well, if the other two are going to incorporate, does that mean that they're just going to leave us, abandon us? And they're going to be off on their own? How can they do that? I thought we were committed together. So we had several months of just trying to help people hear each other, that in each case they seemed to have similar goals, but it was, they were the distant. There's no telephones. I mean, you start realizing what you get used to here. There's not people writing letters. There's, you know, none of these people have typewriters. Some of the people who had jobs had access to that. None of them had cars. So if they were to take the bus from the one location, it took me driving from one area to another an hour and a half. That was with my car. On the bus, it could take 3 hours. One time we went with a group of people just to the beach. It took us 4 hours to get to the beach by bus. Because you take several buses, and then when they come full, then you have to wait for a while. Then you redo your route so you can take a bus to another location, you know, to take a bus back to a location. And then I think it's fair to say one of the missioners showed up at the beach, had driven her car. And the people kind of went, boo. But what it ends up doing is it says, well, we're different than you. You know, we even have mobility or transportation. And so, again, we have to talk to ourselves and say, what are we doing that would seem normal in the States, but here is communicating our differences, which we didn't want to communicate? Yeah. Well, let's say, since hopefully we can run this tape out too, because I always find that this is like an ice cream cone somewhat, and trying to relax with this. To answer that, was one of the real exciting day for me. I met a Presbyterian missionary from Holland, and they were living in what they call popular areas. When they've been a Pueblo Joven for, say, 30 years, so they've got a two-story, they've usually done the battles for electricity and water and stuff, but it still was invaded land. But under one of the governments, a lot of the people got permission to have a paper to show they owned the land. So he and his wife lived there with their three children, and they were trying to do some new work in a brand new Pueblo Joven that looked like a sand dune. And the people had invaded in one area, the government moved them to this location. And they had no water, so they had water trucks. But they did have electricity, because that's real easy. And they had, no sewage, but they... There are some groups who do help in making outhouses and stuff. They hadn't yet started that, but I think that was a goal. The Presbyterian then introduced me to his new coworker, a Peruvian. And in the process, I learned that he was a Pentecostal background. And I thought to myself, gee, I wonder how that works for this Presbyterian from Holland to be working with this sort of Pentecostal guy whose family's come out of the mountains, and now they're in Lima, and they've got together. And so as I got to know him, we went out. He wanted me to go out and see this place where he worked. I said, okay. So we spent the day together and got acquainted in the process. It was a Pueblo Joven with mainly women. In fact, I said, all I see are women and children. And he says, yeah, that's a Pueblo Joven where they call madres solteras, single mothers. And that means that he says they probably are not married, the majority, and that the men who father their children are married and live elsewhere in Lima. He said, we sometimes get peculiar little sectors like that in the Peruvian sociology. Discovered this guy knew all kinds of sociology, and so we went from a Pentecostalist to discussing his perspective on Marxist sociology and why the Marxist system was so useful to him to interpret the political, economic, and sociological network, you might say, that in which he worked. And I thought to myself, how narrow I have been. Because in any Pentecostal I had met in the States, I would have never expected the nature and the depth of the conversation he took it to, out of his concern for pastoring, to want to look at the structures that are demonic and have, as one of the pastors said, if you've just seen Lima, you know that it should make God angry. I mean, in that kind of a sense, and respond that way.